Good to go? Check, check. All right. Let's go ahead and get started. Genesis through Joshua, lesson 28, I believe. The end, folks. Quiet, Mike. Yeah. Genesis through Joshua, lesson 28. Something that you guys will be happy to hear is we're done with the fall. We're done with the fall, and we're moving past that into the next section of the text. So that's exciting. Of course, I have been out the last 2 weeks. So for review, you guys are going to bring me up to speed. I've done this to you once before, so you should have been prepared. What did you learn over the last 2 weeks? What's that? God's will. All right. It's like when you ask a child a Bible question and their answer is, Jesus. Because the answer is Jesus, God, or Bible, right? All the time. So they just answer, Jesus. All right, you can do better than that. Okay, so God's different types of will? Okay. His preceptive will. What's his preceptive will? Right. Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought of that. See, I thought there were only two because I thought the two replaced and superseded the original ten. No? Oh, okay. My bad. The 12 commandments, all right. So God's preceptive will. Yeah, there you go. Getting a little dispensational itch, huh? So God's preceptive will is what he tells us to do, right? What we ought to do, what he commands us to do, etc. It's what he reveals to us. Sometimes it's referred to as his revealed will. Also, it's what he reveals to us that he wants us to be doing, right? And so it's often encompassed in his commands. Good. What's the other type of will that we often discuss? Okay. Decreed of will, right? Or his secret will. And what is that? Come on, we've defined the substance of the term, though. Come on now. Yes. So we affirm, as a Bible-believing, Ephesians-reading Baptist, right, that God decrees all things whatsoever come to pass, right? So anything that comes to pass was part of God's decreed of will. It's what he's decreed to happen, right? It's what has happened because he has set it in motion to happen. So the salvation of one of your loved ones, is that God's preceptive will or his decreed will? If they get saved, it's his decreed will, right? If they don't get saved, but if it's one of your loved ones and they don't end up getting saved, then it actually isn't part of his decreed will because it didn't come to pass, right? So that would be part of his preceptive will in that sense, right? The sense to go out and make disciples of all nations, right? So that's a sticking point oftentimes we get in conversations with Arminians, right? Good. Well, that's some heavy stuff. So did you guys cover that for two Thursdays? Or?
That's all we talked about.
That's good stuff. That was last time I was with you. Okay. Yes.
So that's kind of in there too.
Yeah. Yeah, because we use the term will in multiple ways, right? And so the term will, we think of it as what we're enacting or what we're doing, right? But more than that, we often think of will as what we desire to come to pass, right? And so if you're using the term will in that sense, then it's dispositional will, right? What God's disposition is like, how he feels about a certain situation, right? God's dispositional will often mirrors his preceptive will, in a sense, right? Because he tells us we ought to do something or act a certain way, his disposition is also usually in that, inclined in that direction, that if he told us to do something, he wants us to do it. You know what I mean? So those typically line out. But God's disposition is not necessarily always reflective of his decree, right? So he expresses in the Bible that the wicked, he does not delight in the death of the wicked, that they should perish, but that the wicked should turn from their sin and repent and believe, right? And yet in his decree, there are wicked perishing, right? And we think to ourselves, well, if God is sovereign, why doesn't, and he wants them to be saved, why aren't they saved, right? And it turns out it's because of the mystery of his decree of will, right? We can define it in a sense, but like we talked about, it's his secret will. We don't know exactly what he's doing. We just know that he is sovereign and he has decreed all things, right? Okay, very good. Well, excellent. Last time I was with you, we talked about the fall, right? And we talked about what was happening in the fall, what happened in the garden. We went through all of kind of the effects of the fall last time, and we discussed a bunch of that, how the fall impacted us. Oh, I skipped a page. Man, these notes are going to be all over the place because I'm going to have to use up every spare page of white paper. Holy smokes. Okay, I'm not going to find it, I think. So we'll just go back to here. But that's okay. So here we go. We're getting there. All right, so we talked about the fall, the heart of the rebellion, what it meant to know good and evil in the biblical sense. And then we talked about the effects of the fall, right? And we went through the effects of the fall, etc. But we've moved beyond all of that. We've moved into chapter 4 now, okay? And in chapter 4, and I'm going to come back and use up some of these pages as we go through, but in chapter 4, we get onto a new topic. So the fall has happened. Adam and Eve have been expelled from the garden. I shouldn't have ever turned the page because I'll never find it back, right? It's like a maze if you go the wrong way. There we go. So Adam and Eve have been expelled from the garden, and we are in chapter 4 now. So Genesis chapters 4 through 11 all form kind of a cohesive unit, okay? And so I want to cover them as a whole. That will be the topic of the next several lessons, chapters 4 through 11. We're going to go at an increasing pace, if you will, also. Now, we spent forever in preliminaries in the introduction, right? Then the we spent a really long time in chapters 1 and 2 talking about evolution versus creation, all of those things. And then we spent a shorter, though still long, amount of time on the fall, right, in the garden. Now we're going to kind of increase our pace a little bit, okay? We'll get into 4 through 11, and we're going to be covering entire chapters in single lesson bounds. That's the goal, okay? So as we go into 4 through 11, I want to give you a brief outline of this section as a whole, and then we'll get into the details of chapter 4 as we go into it. So first, this whole section, and well, really chapter 4, but this whole section outlines the enmity between two seeds, okay? The enmity between two seeds. This marker's not the best. I'm going to switch colors on you and really confuse you. So the enmity between two seeds. Anyone have any clue what that reference is? What's that referring to? Okay. Okay, so going forward, looking ahead with our, because we've read chapter 4 before, we know it's referring to Cain and Abel coming up, right, and what's happening there. But in broader strokes, it's between Satan and the people of God, i.e., what we read about back in chapter 3, verse 15. So open your Bibles to Genesis 3:15, and God says to the serpent, right? God says to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel. What's this verse called? Exactly, the Proto-Evangelium, right? And it's so that's a Greek term for first gospel, right? It's the first gospel that we hear in the Bible. God says to the serpent, I am going to put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring, okay? So what's going to happen is Eve is going to propagate, in a sense, a line of people, a race of people, okay? And that line or race of people is going to be in sharp opposition to another line or race of people, the offspring of the serpent, the offspring of Satan. Okay? Now, right away, you get hit with this question. Well, who are Satan's offspring, right? If we have offspring of Satan and offspring of the woman, how do we know who belongs to which category, right? Does offspring of Satan refer to demons? Does it refer to people? If so, how are they the seed of the serpent and not the seed of Eve, since she's the mother of all living, right? Her and Adam are the original forefathers of the entire human race. So there gets to be that question, okay? And that's something that we're going to look at going forward. But this whole section then, as a whole, is the enmity between the two seeds, and we get into that in detail in chapter 4, okay? So it's kind of the two seeds, the two lines are basically what's going on through chapter 11. We've got these two lines or races of people, seed of the serpent, seed of the woman, and they continuously battle in war against one another. If not physically, they do so spiritually, right? And those two lines battle until verse 11, basically. Or chapter 11, I'm sorry. But it's the heart of this begins in chapter 4, okay? Then, at the end of chapter 4, then, we arrive at a new section. Genesis 5, 1 through 6, 8, okay? Genesis 5, 1 through 6, 8 is the Toledot of Adam. Okay, 5, 1 through 6, 8 is the Toledot of Adam. 6, 9 through 9, 29. Big section here, 6:9 through 9:29 is the Toledot of Noah. And then 10:1 through 11:9. Is the Toledot, I know you're surprised, of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Exactly. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Tanner, why are you throwing Hebrew words at us? Does anyone remember what this word is, what it means? What it signifies? The generations of, right? So anytime your book of Genesis says, these are the generations of so-and-so, these are the generations of such-and-such, the Hebrew word is toledot, right? Now, what does that signify in the text itself? What good is a toledot? Okay, I said that the... Exactly. It's tracing a line. It's looking forward. It's forward pointing to the line that's coming up. And again, it has a narrowing effect. Also, they act as natural chapter breaks in the book, right? I said that rather than reading Genesis 1, Genesis 2, Genesis 3, you'd be much better off reading Toledot to Toledot, right? Because those are the broad narrative structures. Those are the natural delineations of the book itself, right? So in this broad overarching section of 4 through 11, we have three natural breaks or Toledotes, okay? We've got the Toledot of Adam, the Toledot of Noah, and the Toledot of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These are the generations of Adam, these are the generations of Noah, etc., right? So that's the breakdown that we have going forward through these next several chapters, okay? But now, I don't want to spend too much time on that, I just wanted to give you an outline or an overview. Now let's get into Genesis 4, okay? We see the first outworking in Genesis 4. We see the first outworking of what we described as our large heading. Our large heading is the enmity between two seeds. That first outworking is seen in Genesis chapter 4. So God promised that there would be enmity, and sure enough, we see it right away in the next chapter, Genesis chapter 4. Of course, I'm referring to the struggle between Cain and Abel, right? The first outworking is Cain and Abel. And so if you'll follow along with me in your Bibles, I want to read chapter 4 together. So Adam and Eve have been cast out of the garden, turned away from the tree of life so that they may not eat while they're in this state, and they're sent out. Chapter 4, now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord God had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, I shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. Then the Lord said to him, not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken upon him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And I won't go on from there. We'll be mostly in this section. So, first thing I want to note is in verse 1, Adam knew his wife Eve, she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Now, you don't want to read too much into this, but I was pointing out before that Eve is looking for the fulfillment to verse 15 in chapter 3, right? She's looking forward to the fulfillment of the proto-evangelion. She's saying, where is this seed of mine who will rise up and crush the serpent's head? Where is he? And there's a sense, I wouldn't push it too hard, but there's a sense that when Cain is born, her saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord, is perhaps her looking forward to this seed. Perhaps Cain is the seed, she may be thinking. Okay, I wouldn't press that too far. If someone showed me from Scripture that may not be the case, I would back down. But I think there might be a hint of that, her looking forward to that here in this verse. She's looking at Cain and potentially saying, this may be the seed. This might be the one who will crush the serpent's head. Praise be to God, he has given me a son. So that's the first thing to note. But the narrative quickly takes a different turn. She bore then his brother Abel, and now we have Abel being a keeper of the sheep and Cain being a worker of the ground. In the course of time, they give offerings. This is interesting because we don't have any formal prescriptive ways in which to give offerings to God, to offer up sacrifices to Him, and yet they're doing it. So obviously, this is something that they have learned in some way, shape, or form, right? We're a long time away from Moses, and yet here they are bringing offerings. So that's interesting, right? Maybe God has communicated to them and told them this is something He requires of them. We don't know, right? But they come to bring their offerings, and Abel's offering is accepted, while Cain's offering is rejected. And so one of the first questions that we want to answer is, why is Cain's offering rejected? Why is Cain's offering rejected? Right. It doesn't. So let's try to get a little bit of idea. I like what you pointed at. So there's a sense in which if you look back at when God cast them out of the garden, and we noted that that was the first sacrifice, right? That God had to, if He was going to make clothing for them with skins, He had to kill an animal in order to do that, right? And so that's the first kind of sacrifice or a substitution, if you will, to make them clothing. Now, we get to Cain and Abel's sacrifice, and we can't help but think a little bit that Abel's sacrifice resembles at least the rest of Old Testament sacrifices in the sense that it is a bloody sacrifice, right? Whereas Cain's sacrifice doesn't. And so that's something that may get us to think, okay, maybe the issue is the fact that Cain's sacrifice was bloodless. His offering was bloodless. So I want to go to a few verses and see what they have to say about this. First, somebody turn for us to Leviticus 17:11. Couple of you guys could turn there, and then somebody else turn to Hebrews 9:22. So, who's got Leviticus 17:11? Raise your hand. Okay, we've got a few people there. Who's got Hebrews 9:22? Okay. So, someone read Leviticus 17:11 for us. What does it say? Okay, so the life is in the blood, right? And it is the giving of the life by the shedding of the blood that makes atonement for sin, according to Leviticus 17:11. This is what atones for sin. And so there's a sense in which if we're giving sacrifice to God, it's likely, at least the biblical pattern is, it's on behalf of our sin. And if we're doing that, Leviticus 17:11 tells us that a bloody sacrifice, if you will, is the kind of sacrifice that atones for sin because it is the shedding of blood or the spilling of life, if you will. Good. Now, Hebrews 9:22, what does that say? Hebrews 9:22, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins, right? There is no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. So again, we look at Abel's sacrifice. It looks quite a bit like the sacrifices that we see in the Mosaic Covenant in the book of Leviticus, right? We look at Cain's sacrifice. It doesn't seem to mimic that at all. However, something else was mentioned, okay? Something else was mentioned. What was the other potential understanding of why Cain's offering was rejected? Attitude, right? Heart attitude. Heart attitude. So someone turn for me to Hebrews 11:4. And that's going to be the only one we're going to go over.
By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his guilt, and by it he being dead yet speaking.
Boom. So this not only refers to the event in actuality, but it seems to describe for us why Abel's offering, at least, was better than Cain's, right? And so what did it say was the reason?
By faith.
By faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain. Something else that I think helps us to understand this, are bloody sacrifices the only sacrifices in the Old Testament or Old Covenant? No, what other sacrifices were often given? Right, there were drink offerings, right, that were often given. What else? Grain offerings. And it's helpful to note, the Hebrew term here used for Cain's offering is the same Hebrew term that's used for grain offerings in Leviticus. The exact same Hebrew term is used here. So, we know that offerings of the land can also be godly and offered to God correctly, because he explicitly gives us grain offerings, right? And there's a sense in which Cain's offering very much could have been a type of grain, early grain offering. And then Hebrews 11:4 tells us explicitly it was by faith that Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain. Okay? So, Cain's offering is rejected because he didn't bring it in faith. If Cain brought his offering in faith, even though it were of the ground and was not a bloody offering, there is a strong biblical precedence, I think, that his offering would have been accepted. But it was rejected because he did not bring it in faith. I do not know of that, but that would be very interesting to look into. I'm sure there's got to be some writings in some other areas.
You know, but whoever it was that wrote Hebrews, they mentioned this by faith.
Yes.
So he must have had an understanding of this.
Yes.
So if it wasn't taught from the Pentateuch or something like that, it must have been taught somewhere.
Yes.
It must have taught from
faith. Yes. And that's the writer of the Hebrews' goal in chapter 11, right? He's giving this great hall of faith, right? Trying to prove that all of the Old Testament saints were justified before God on the basis of faith, not on works, right? That's the goal of the author of Hebrews, especially there in chapter 11. But it's interesting that he goes explicitly to this event and says, Abel's offering was accepted because he brought it in faith. Cain's was not good, in a sense, by implication, because he didn't bring it in faith. So it's Cain's response, it's Cain's lack of faith that really betrays this fact. And to cement this real quick, look at Cain's response to God when God calls him on the carpet, if you will. What happens? Yeah, he's angry. He doesn't display at all the type of attitude you would expect from somebody who did bring their offering in faith, right? In goodwill. His response, God comes to him says to him in verse 6, "Why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted?" I'm sorry, further down. So he murders his brother in 8 through 9, and then the Lord speaks to him in verse 10. "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. Now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, he curses him," etc. And he says, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." Is he repentant as to what happened? No, he's not upset at all that he murdered his brother Cain, or brother Abel. He's upset he got caught, if you will, right? My punishment is greater than I can bear. Not, "Lord, I slew my brother, forgive me." Not that kind of attitude at all, right? He's upset he's being punished, right? It's the classic saying that we say out here in the world when we talk about people who, they're not sorry, They're sorry they got caught, right? That Cain displays that exact attitude here. My punishment's greater than I can bear, right? I don't care that I killed my brother. My punishment's greater than I can bear. And that's what he's sad about to God. So his attitude, his response, Cain's response betrays the fact that he isn't actually repentant, right? And so, in our first outworking of the enmity between two seeds, who wins? The serpent. The seed of the serpent wins in the first battle, if you will, right? But he will not win the war, as we see through the story of the scriptures. But in the first battle, in the first outworking of this response, the serpent wins, if you will. And I'm going to put it in quotes, because whenever the devil thinks he's winning, he's not really winning, right? He really thought he was winning when he crucified the Lord of Glory on the cross, right? And that really came back to bite him, didn't it? So the serpent wins, if you will. Of course, it's all according to the plan of God, but the serpent wins the first battle, if you will. And then we begin to see, so sin triumphs in Abel's death. The sin is propagating. It's continuing to grow. And what happens to Cain after he murders his brother? Right, he goes off to live in the land of Nod. And something I want to see here, we see an exchange between God and Cain that's very reminiscent of an exchange we just saw in Genesis chapter 3. Why? God is bringing a cursing. He brings a curse upon Cain, right? In a sense, sin triumphs, and the curse of the fall intensifies, right? What was one of the aspects of the curse particularly related to the man in Genesis 3? When he worked the ground, it was going to be hard, right? It was going to be difficult by the sweat of your brow, etc. What does God say to Cain now in regards to this same thing? Verse 12, when you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. So the exact same curse that was pronounced upon Adam, right, is intensified on Cain for sin. In a sense, sin triumphs and intensifies, and so too the curse intensifies as well. And this goes all through man's history. As the sin continues to intensify and grow, so too does the curse, right? The curse continues to bring man down. So he's directly addressed from God in verse 11. He becomes a wanderer in the land in verse 12. And then in verse 14, verse 12, wanderer. And what happens in verse 14? He's... yeah. Exactly. So he's alienated not only from God now, but also from his fellow man, right? There's almost a sense in which when Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden, yes, they were alienated from God, but they had each other in a sense. Now Cain is alienated not only from God, but alienated from man as well. He's there's a sense in which he's completely alienated from his fellow man. Good. Well, not good. That's bad. But, and then in the rest of the narrative, we begin to catch a glimpse of the development of the ungodly line, right? in a sense, the seed of the serpent. So, the question I asked at the beginning, how do we recognize, what is the difference between one who is a member or a seed of the serpent and one who is a seed of the woman? What's the difference? Exactly. Yep. Yep, exactly. So they lack faith, as we caught a glimpse into in Hebrews, right? Hebrews told us the seed of the serpent that's coming about, and as we see this development of the ungodly line, they lack faith in God and are opposed to Him, right? So that's the first thing that we notice here in the text. The seed of the serpent lack faith in God, they're opposed to Him, etc. Now, what happens in the New Testament, the New Covenant, is that the strong man, according to Jesus, is Satan. He is the serpent, and he possesses the nations, right? The nations are his. They're all the seeds of the serpent. Because as these lines develop, God chooses a specific and particular people that are, in a sense, the seed of the woman. Israel, right? And Israel works out to produce the heir, right? But something that's so profound in the new covenant is Jesus starts stealing the seeds of the serpent, the Gentiles. He tells a parable of how can somebody steal the strong man's goods unless he first breaks into the strong man's house, binds him, then he is free to plunder from his house. That's exactly what happens in the New Covenant. Those who are naturally, by birth, seed of the serpent are now being brought into the family of God, and they become seeds of Eve, seeds of the woman, by virtue of their faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, because Jesus binds the strong man and plunders his goods from him. And that is how then the gospel now goes out to all nations, right? That's that tie. That's why in the New Covenant now it's to all nations rather than just to Israel.
So would they really be, I mean, if they're elect,
right? Yes. Of the woman. Yes. In the sense, if we look from God's perspective, we're always His. He elect us from before the foundations of the world, and then He comes in and saves us, and we were, in a sense, always His. He always had His right or claim over us. But in real time, in our lives, we do go through a real and genuine conversion where we were once acting, just like you said, as seeds of the serpent, but now we act like seeds of the woman, those who desire to honor and glorify God with their lives and put their faith in the living God, right? So because we go through that real conversion in time, it appears and is genuinely the case that we are being converted to the family of God, right? As Paul says, at one time, you were not of Him, but now you are of Him, right? And then in another place, he talks about how, but such were some of you, but you have repented, you've turned, etc., and put your faith in the living God. So that's just something, I'm getting a little off track, but I wanted you to see how this carries out. Because this broad narrative arc goes through all of the Old Testament. This seed of the woman and seed of the serpent, they continuously battle all the way until the New Testament, and then things radically change when God formulates a plan to start plundering seeds from the serpent, right? His seed, He begins plundering from them and taking them for His own. Good. So now let's go into the development of this ungodly line. And we begin to see that. I ended in verse 16. And so we can see the development of this ungodly line in 17 through the rest of the text. Okay? Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
The Lord said to him, therefore,
Okay. Here, we'll put it in the corner, huh? What is this sign? Okay. So we'll note that as we continue. So now 17 through the rest of the chapter. Cain knew his wife. She conceived and bore Enoch. Different Enoch. When he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad fathered Mahujael, and Mahujael fathered Methushael, and then Methushael fathered Lamech. And Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Adah, the name of the other Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of those who play the lyre and pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. So I'm going to end there, because that's where we see the development of the ungodly line. So as we see the development of the ungodly line, what are some things that you see in happening? What are some of the things you follow through this, particularly I'm looking through the genealogies, what's going on in the development of...
Civilization is becoming specialized.
Absolutely. So civilization, we see the development and specialization of civilization and culture. Okay, and right away, we see, even in spite of this being the seed of the serpent and the iniquity that Cain has brought upon that seed, we see immediately still the kindness and grace of God, right? The grace of God in that they are growing, expanding, specializing in civilization and culture, right? And so let's look at a few of the things that God blesses them with. First, in verse 17, they're able to build a city, right? And he names it after Enoch, right? Right. There you go. So you can see he denies God in a sense in killing his brother Abel. He denies God in how he speaks to God and rejects God and is not repentant, right? And then God gives him a curse and he does everything in his own power to lift the curse, if you will, from himself, right? Absolutely. But in the face of his iniquity and sin, there is still a blessing from God in that he is blessing this ungodly line even with the ability to build up a civilization, etc. Right? It's kind of one of those things that you see Joshua refer to far later in the text when he says, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. Right? The same act, building a city, was something that Cain did in rejection to spite God, if you will, but God meant it for good, in a sense, to bring blessing upon a wayward and stiff-necked people, to use the biblical terminology. So, verse 17, they build a city, right? Named after Enoch, different Enoch. What else happens? I'm not going to give you all the answers now. We'll get to that. Yes. We'll get to the whole Lamech situation. We're still looking at good things that God is blessing them with in the genealogy. Yes, exactly. So in Jubal, verse 21, we get music. Okay? We which is obviously a tremendous blessing from God. The ability to play the lyres, the pipes, etc. You don't need me to tell you how much of a blessing music is upon anybody as a people, regardless of whether or not they're following God. Obviously, the goal with music is to glorify and honor God. It's a way to bring praises to Him and to worship Him. But music affects men and women in a very particular way because of how God made us, right? And so that's a great blessing from God that we can enjoy music. As a side note, there is music, different music for different times and situations because it connects with the emotional part of you as a human being. So Jesus, when he condemns the Pharisees, he says, "We played the lyre for you and you did not dance," because it was happy, upbeat music. "We played the dirge for you and you did not mourn," or you did not lament. There's certain musics for certain times, for certain periods, right? And so that's one of the things that God has given us. Music helps us to connect with our inward person, our emotions in particular, and that's a helpful and blessing to us. So good. This is the first time we see music mentioned in verse 21. What else do you see? There you go, the Bronze Age. Tubal Cain, right? I like his name, by the way. Tubal Cain. That just sounds like a Bronze Age name. Tubal Cain, craftsmanship, right? So we get craftsmanship. They're able to make all sorts of tools and instruments and forge and all this stuff, again, through God's blessing. Also, we don't know exactly how much time has passed here, but it's interesting that, like you said, from the evolutionist perspective, man struggled on for many, many years without any sort of instruments or anything like that, tools, right? And in the biblical narrative, we seem to get them fairly early, right? Just an interesting contrast there. And one final thing to note is Jabel, husbandry, comes into play, right? In verse 20, we get husbandry. JD went back there to tell Rod I was preaching heresy. I feel bad about that. I feel bad about my heresy. Oh, there he is.
What is the deal with the naming of Tubal Cain's sister? Because we hear from her again?
Let's see, where it says Nama?
Yes.
I do not know. Let me see if it's anywhere in the Bible. Nope, this is the only time we hear of her. Her name, she's also obviously completely removed, but the same name is the name of one of Solomon's wives later on in Kings and Chronicles. But other than that, we don't hear anything about Naamah. So I don't know the significance of that. So we get all these developments and technologies by the grace of God in that line, okay? And finally, in Lamech, we see, again, a strong and swift progression of sin, right? Swift progression of sin. What's the first thing? It's already been noted. What's the first thing that we note about Lamech and his situation? Exactly. He defied marriage by taking two wives, right? Yes, polygamy, exactly. So, he took two wives, which was against God's plan and ideas. Polygamy is something in the Old Testament that is one of those things that God allows in some cases, but it's never spoken of as the right way or the proper way, etc. So we know that many of the patriarchs, even as we get further into the narrative, also took several wives, right? And it's one of those things that it is never God's best, right? It's not what God desired when he created the ordinance of marriage. One man, one woman, the rest of their lives. That is God's plan in marriage, and polygamy perverts that plan. And you can see the text goes out of its way to point that out, right? It goes out of its way explicitly to say that he took two wives. And in verse 19, it's going through the... it's still in the middle of the genealogy, and it says, and Lamech took two wives. And it goes out of its way to say that, because again, this is not God's plan. It doesn't follow his ordinance of marriage. Good. What else does Lamech do? He killed a man, and what I want to point out explicitly is he boasts about killing a man, right? He boasts about killing. He draws his wives together, right? And sings them this poem, right? That he likely learned from good old, who do we got here? Jubal. Jubal taught him music, and so he drew together, I'm going to sing a song, I'm going to build a poem and sing it to my wives, and it is an abomination. Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. Now, I did a lot of reading on this, and I want you to know that there are a myriad of interpretations of how to understand this poem. Okay, some say he killed two men. Okay, I killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. Some say he killed one man, and then he killed a young man, okay? Others say no, this was clearly two ways using Hebrew parallelism to revert to one person that he killed. He's just, in his poetry, saying it twice, right, for emphasis, right? I tend to go with the latter group. I think he killed one man, according to it. Others say he didn't kill anyone at all. The tense in which the killing verb is, it's the perfect tense. The question is it past perfect? I.e. something he did in the past, or is it present or future perfect? Some think that he is saying, I will kill a man. He is trying to show how buff and macho he is to his wives and saying, if anyone comes after Lamech, I will kill them for wounding me or striking me. If they do something so small as wound me or strike me, I will kill them. And if Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. So some say he's trying to kind of have this macho thing going. If anyone comes after Lamech, he's going to kill him, kind of thing.
He has no mercy, no forgiveness.
Right. Exactly. I tend to think he actually did kill somebody, one man. But again, there's a myriad of interpretations on this. Some say various different things, ways of interpreting it. Regardless, his song is a boast about killing and about... in a sense, especially killing for something small, right? I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me, right? Just, we've got the idea of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's present often in the Old Testament. We'll get to that, right? But Lamech takes that and throws it out the window, right? He says, it's not an eye for an eye. If you so much as wound or strike Lamech, he's going to kill you. I'm going to wipe you out, kind of thing, right? So that's his attitude, okay? And then the last thing is the revenge. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. What do you guys make of that? Yeah, there you go. Sure.
That he's been successful. But how was he avenged?
I think it's a direct reference. I don't think the vengeance was necessarily carried out, but I think it's a direct reference to verse 15 where God says, if anyone kills him, he says, let's see. Then the Lord said to him, not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken upon him sevenfold. So I don't think he's referring to something that's actually happened, but it's just a reference to that. It was probably carried down as lore, right? Where Cain told everyone, this mark means that if I am killed, then God will return sevenfold vengeance upon them, right? And so Lamech is like you said, he's got an inflated sense of self-worth. He thinks he's much more valuable than Cain, much more worthy of that kind of vengeance, right? I'd also like to point out, there's a sense in which Lamech's vengeance is self-established. At least in Cain's situation, if he gets killed, the vengeance that's visited upon his murderer is visited by God, right? God says, if anyone kills Cain, I will avenge him sevenfold, right? Lamech's either is him saying he's going to avenge himself 77-fold, right? And not doing what Romans says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. No, Lamech says, I will repay, saith Lamech, right? So he's taking it upon himself, or he's demanding of God a greater vengeance, right? In either way, it's bad, right? He's either saying, I'm going to take it upon myself to avenge myself 77-fold, or he's saying that God ought to avenge me 77-fold. Either way, it's bad. Okay? And so, we have the development of the ungodly line in Genesis chapter 4. Let's read this last little section. It'll be just a bit of a teaser for next time. Chapter 4, verses 25 through the end. Now we shift gears. We're done with the ungodly line. Now the text begins to look at the godly line once more. Verse 25, and Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. To Seth a son was born. He called his name Enosh. At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. So she, again, Eve is looking for the fulfillment to Genesis 3:15, right? Cain killed Abel, who could have been the seed. Perhaps Seth is the seed. Again, I might be reading into the text a little bit there, but I think it's reasonable. Seth may be the seed. She's, again, looking for the seed. And another offspring is appointed. And then at the end of verse 26, you have something in stark contrast with the godly line. They're doing something that the ungodly line hasn't done at all. What are they doing? They're calling upon the name of the Lord. Now, I'll tell you this. A previous pastor I was under took this text, and he took a different interpretation. He said a better translation of call upon the name of the Lord is to blaspheme the name of the Lord. And he took it in a negative sense, that it because it's following, it's this section is just after the line of Cain, he took it in a negative sense. I read many authors and commentators on it. Very few take it in the blaspheme or to call out the name of the Lord in the sense of blaspheming his name. The vast majority of scholars interpret it as calling upon in the sense of worship or prayer. Okay, and I think that makes the most sense because in verse 25 we've switched from the ungodly line to the godly line now. And we're talking about those who are trying to follow God with their lives. But I just wanted to make you aware of that difference. And so I don't think that there's a couple interpreters who have interpreted it as blaspheme. I think he got that because some older Jewish scholars have interpreted as to blaspheme the name of the Lord or to cry out against him. But again, I think it's much more consistent with the context and flow of the text to view this as it seems to come across. They call upon the name of the Lord. They're calling out to him, worshiping him, praying to him, asking him to guide them and help them. Okay?
My Bible, this is the one here, NIV.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To proclaim,
right. So to proclaim, and like I said, some have interpreted that proclaim or call out as in a sense to speak out in a blasphemous way, right? But I just don't think that's consistent with the text.
I didn't take proclaim.
I would neither, right? But some have taken, they go to the original Hebrew, right? And they try to take it that way. Again, I don't think it's as consistent with the text. So, but I just want to make you aware of that difference for some people. I know when my old pastor was preaching that from the pulpit, I was like, what? And then I immediately went home and I looked up every commentary I had trying to, and I couldn't find it anywhere, right? Anywhere I couldn't find it. And then after doing a lot more digging, I finally had found that, okay, some older Jewish scholars, he was a big fan because of his dispensationalism. He loved reading older Jewish scholars and things like that and stuff. And so it oftentimes drew him away, I felt, from the true meaning of the text because he was trying to read dispensational ideals into it. So anyway, but that's the end of that section. And of course, you can see in chapter 5, it begins with the new Toledot. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Okay, and it begins to go into the Toledot of Adam and that genealogy. Okay, so next time, we will go into that in more detail. So, look, we finished a whole chapter in one evening. I told you we're speeding up. Yeah, that is light speed for me. You guys know it to be true. Okay, so we're going 100 miles an hour right now. But I hope it was helpful for you guys and you're able to pick up some stuff there. Next time we'll be in the Toledot of Adam, 5:1 through 6:8. I don't know that we'll get to the Toledot of Noah, but we may. I would advise you, as we go through this section, to read through up through chapter 11 kind of every week, just to kind of get caught back up into the narrative flow and what's going on in the text, because we'll be in this section through chapter 11 for some time. Are there any questions on chapter 4 or what we discussed tonight? Any further questions?